thinking, is anybody who hasn't come. I always record. My voice comes out much more strongly than yours. So if you can speak freely, and it barely comes out on the recording, and if for any reason you speak and you decide later you don't want anyone else outside the room to hear it, it's very easy to edit you out. So I'd much rather you just felt comfortable and we all just talked. The purpose of the recordings is that the audience for whatever we do is bigger afterwards than it ever is in the moment. And a lot of times people get a lot of benefit. But I don't want that ever to inhibit what happens here. So feel free to be frank and then later say, would you take me out of that recording? And it doesn't hurt. Then they'll just have my side of it without knowing. Okay. Your shoes and your socks are quite amusing today. Entertaining, I think, is actually the word. People have a lot more fun with their clothes. Mm-hmm. There's no the children wear mismatched socks. You can buy mismatched socks. I remember as a child always wondering, why did they have to match? It always seemed so odd to me. Hi, Ramila, nice to have you. Okay, one more chair. This is the final effort. No, it's we'll bring you to the front. It's just easier. There you go. It's just more friendly. All right. Ramila has a little boy in her tummy right now. Isn't that nice? She's just beginning to show. And his due date is Swami's birthday. Very auspicious. All right. So today's topic is very tender. So we can go lots of different directions, but I would really like to make it work for all of us. I mean, I know about some of your lives, and though not all of it, and I know all of us have been through more experiences, perhaps, than we might like to have, we would have chosen for ourselves. We had our life agenda, and then God had his, and then here we are. So I know you all, but for the sake of our discussion, introduce yourselves, because not everybody knows everybody. And if you have a particular intention in being here today, I would appreciate it if you would just give me an idea of what you might hope, you know, a couple of hours from now to have gathered from our discussion. Olga, I'm going to start with you. Okay? We'll see why you're here. All right. I hope it's not to waste your time and wish you stayed home. All right. Larry.
Hi, I'm Larry, and, well, I mostly wanted to be here just to be polite, to be honest with you.
Uh-huh.
But more specifically, this series that you've done, Wisdom of the Heart or Healing of the Heart,
mm-hmm.
I've listened to all of them, and maybe a year or so ago on one of the talks, I was going through like a difficult challenge in business, you know, self-created, and one of somebody asked you a question, because they were also going through a business thing, and you asked, I don't remember exactly what their situation was, but basically they were in fear, insecurity, or they were going through a reorganization, and you just basically said, you know, look to see, how can you serve, how can I help, you know, how can I, you know, increase your happiness, and what's it like in your situation and your circumstance. And I really, that just rang true with me, and I tried to apply that. I've always tried to apply it, but somehow it reinforced what I knew is true, and it really helped me clarify and make a shift, and it made a difference.
Oh, that's nice.
So I couldn't pass this up.
Thank you. That's very good. So gratifying. You know, one casts, shines one's little flashlight out into the dark, and it's very nice to know when the light's caught.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. All right.
I'm Hannah.
Uh-huh.
And let's see. I was kind of trying to feel in my heart why I'm here. I've been wanting to come to a Saturday class for a while.
Uh-huh.
And I've been really, in the past few months, trying to live my life more in the heart and less in the intellect and thinking mind, and just going into the thinking mind when I have to.
Mm-hmm.
But I notice, like even right now, sharing this, it can be really scary to live in the heart all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And to lead from the heart, because our world, especially the society here, is set up in such a way that is very intellectual and very rational.
Mm-hmm.
And so the heart when you live from the heart, it's living from intuitive perception and all-encompassing sense of love and connection. And that isn't always fostered in our society. So that's just been a theme in my life. And I'm always, with the grace of God and Master, trying to just peel away the layers of fear and past experiences that limit me from living in that way.
That's all very exact. Thank you.
Yeah.
There's a few questions I'll ask about that, but I'll wait till we get a little farther. Ermila.
Hi, Ermila.
Mm-hmm.
So how much pain I've experienced really in my life decisions, not in the sense that they were wrong decisions, but just following the cultural mindset of being like that, and how things don't go as expected, and we keep banging our heads against it until we see that there has to be something else. And that's what really brings us to the spiritual path. And it frankly overwhelmed me how much did I suffer and how many lifetimes. And it was a scary thought. But thank God that I have this path master, that I've seen or felt the love or the joy that is within us. But I've also recently, in the past couple of years, I consciously turn away from any pain or suffering in an experience, and I look for the joy in it. And ironically, it has now played a game where even pain feels, it gives you that comfort of attachment a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Like your memories or people who have passed away or whatever that is.
That's true.
Pain, in a way, it's painful and you learn a lesson. Or then it's that familiarity of things.
Yeah.
And that's just mind-boggling to me now. And
it
this is a good opportunity to grow beyond that even.
Hmm.
Or not just hold on to the pain as a connection to the past. Or
yeah, it's very true. You know, this may be a little more extreme, certainly not anything you've experienced in your lifetime, but when a friend of mine, when her husband died, and he'd been ill, but he died unexpectedly, and I think he was less than 60, so he wasn't an elderly man. And being a devotee, I mean, she had all the understanding she needed, that death wasn't a tragedy and so on. But after a time, she stated so simply, and I know this is actually true, others have said it, I mean, she said, if I stop grieving, she said, grief is all I have left. And as soon as I stop grieving and actually go on with my life, she said, then he's really gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so obvious. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a very poignant moment, and she was conscious enough to see that. Yeah. So it's a very subtle, very interesting point. Yes. All right, Deepak.
Hi, I'm Deepak. I wanted to come to this class because I read the description and I kind of felt that this is for me.
Mm-hmm.
Always thought that there's some intelligence to the heart,
yes,
more than the brain, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more of curiosity that I have.
Okay.
And learning and being open.
Okay,
so
excellent.
Whatever comes.
Deepak, how long have you been living in the U.S.?
About 9 years.
Oh, 9 years. Did you come to school here?
Yes.
And then just stayed on?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Just do you have a family? No, you don't, because you live in the community, so I know that you
my
don't.
My family is in India, and some of my family is in Australia.
In Australia. What part of India are you from? Bangalore. Okay. Just curious. Thank you for filling in my curiosity. I love the complete mishmash, especially that California is. It's just perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're definitely Dwapara Yuga. We're on our way.
I think this is probably the most diverse place I've seen in the world.
In the whole world. I know, it's just, I had to laugh, this is just silly, but Ananda has a centers, you know, of course, in India, and Dhyana, Nayaswami Dhyana, who is the head of the center in Gurgaon, she, every Monday, she goes off to a certain places. She goes to this particular shopping mall, and she goes to a sponsor. That's been, she's the only American in India who's never been in the hospital because she really is taking care of herself. So they opened a Starbucks in this shopping mall because it's all becoming one world, and she was well known over there, so she actually did the dedication ceremony for the Starbucks, you know. This was marvelous. I mean, really. And then further, when I was visiting her, and it was Monday, we went off together to the spa and to the shopping mall and so on. And so we went into Starbucks, of course, and we walk in.
Those shopping malls in Gurgaon are so big.
I know, and they're just...
You get lost in them.
They're amazing. That's like, it's a holiday. So we go to the Starbucks, and I look around, and it's a bunch of young Indian people sitting at the counters with their Apple computers open, drinking coffee. And I said, this is Palo Alto. This is, you know, even the Indian people, you know, was nothing odd at all about it to me. But it was marvelous. Anyway, there we go. So, Katerina.
So, I'm Katerina. I'm from Finland, and I'm only here for this week, so it's like in whether Russia is teaching, I'm attending. Mm-hmm. But also, I'm at a stage where for a couple of years, I was working really hard to just do research, and I was trying to get my research to just shift it and do like more mindfulness and compassion research, and now like I've reached a tipping point when everything is just like unfolding, and it's unfolding really fast, and there's just like more people, more projects, and more of everything, and now I'm at a point where I'm like, okay, so like what should I say yes to, mm-hmm. and like I feel like everything, you know, when I look at it, like everything sounds amazing and all the people are amazing, but it's not possible for me to commit to everything, so mm-hmm. I'm looking for how should I orient myself with this? And I feel like, dropping from my head to my heart and trying to just attune myself more to just know, like, what is, you know, not only, like, what is good to do, but what are my next best steps?
Right, so exactly. The right questions. Okay, very good. Karen.
My name is Karen, uh-huh. And I was just sitting here chanting and noticing that that's the first time in that chant, you know, I always thought that I was saying to God, listen.
Right.
Listen to my heart song, my soul song. But I realized, no.
You're talking to yourself.
Me.
Just for that, okay. That's why I like that chant, because it actually has dual meaning to it. You can take it either way. It's either an affirmation to self or a prayer to God. And either way, it works. Yeah. And when I sing it, I sort of flip back and forth, depending on the moment. You know the karmic cycle that we're in. Excellent.
I'm so glad that you chose that, that it came through. And also, I just wanted to reflect on what you said on the and your comment about your friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's really important about, you know, just these painful experiences of the past to just somehow use them as a catalyst, use them as a way to move forward instead of holding on to them.
It's very complicated. All right. So I think where we'll start is, I'll just talk a little bit about my understanding of the heart and the mind from a yogic perspective, so we can have a shared vocabulary, in essence. I did read somewhere recently where because they keep doing all more and more subtle medical research, that they've determined that there's an enormous physiological resemblance between the brain and the heart, that a lot of what they consider to be brain cells are also present in the heart, and so the whole mechanical idea of what creates thought, what creates consciousness, and they're always trying to find the physical evidence and that results in the non-physical manifestation, which interestingly, you know, the whole Western approach has been to go from what you see outside yourself and try to understand. And the amazing thing is how much they've been able to understand of non-physical things just by going into the material world. This has been part of the East and the West. The East is the sages went inside, and from that inner experience, they understood all of creation. And the West went outside, and it's coming toward the inner realization that the Vedas and the saints were always coming to, but through all this practical understanding of how the world works, which is where Master said that East and West would unite, specifically India and America. The practical efficiency of the West, America particularly, and the spiritual understanding of the East, and together, prior to this time, cosmic time, the Yuga of Kali Yuga that we were in, the way Swami quoted Master as saying, is that consciousness was not subtle enough to hold both the understanding of the external world and the understanding of the internal world. So Kali Yuga descending, essentially, it divided. The East specialized in internal reality and gradually disintegrated. We'll use India as the primary, gradually disintegrated to a large extent on the external level. Of course, England came and took all the wealth, but nonetheless it was the karma to have that happen. And the West just rose up like this economically, but increasingly has just been in a famine state spiritually. So now, and even with this, I was this crossing over, I was reading in Conversations with Yogananda, one of the entries that we were doing in our class recently, said, Katarina, there's also a bathroom in the back with if you need anything. Okay. He said there has been, he used the phrase cross incarnation, that Indians, and because your soul has no nationality, but presumably those souls who are in greatest harmony with the Indian way of being have incarnated in America, and souls that are very American by inclination have incarnated in India, so that the two realities will just, because all those men and women that I saw in Gurgaon in Starbucks, they had dark skin and dark eyes, but their entire consciousness was Western. Whereas I'm part of a very large group of Americans who are just like totally bewildered by America. And when I first went to India, 30 years ago, India looked more like India. It didn't look so much like California. But it was just like, this is, you know, where everybody understands spiritual life. Here, you have this very narrow thread of people who will talk to you about it here. It's getting wider, but still narrow. In India, everybody, the fruit seller, the taxi driver, everybody just knows the fundamental purpose of life, however confused things might be on both sides. What was it? More recently, when Ananda put out our movie, the Finding Happiness movie, which is a story about Ananda, Shivani, who was the executive producer of that movie, spent many months in India getting that movie launched and so on, and I went with her to carry her briefcase for about a 3-week promotions trip on that. And we did lots of private showings of it. And, Supreme Court justices and heads of state and, regional governors and cabinet members, very, very nationally prominent individuals who were always the cousin or the sister-in-law or the brother of somebody who was in our group, all came to these events and were very, very respectful and appreciative. We were just saying to each other, not a chance in America. There's just not a chance that even, one national, especially not that kind of prominence, public servant. There's just none. It just wouldn't happen. Even if they had a private interest, they wouldn't come. It's just not, it's just such a different world that we live in. Now, what was the end point of that? Oh, it was about East and West, separating heart and mind. And the wisdom of the heart. From a yogic point of view, Yogananda makes a simple statement. A lot of what Master said was just little aphorisms, just very laconic. And he said, reason follows feeling. Those are three words, but they're just, it has an amazing implication when you take it. In the book I wrote about Swami Kriyananda, one of the stories in there, I talked about just something he'd said to me, where he said, when people talk about meditating, we tend to talk about how to calm the mind, and we're always talking about how to get beyond thought. He said, the restlessness does not emanate from the mind. He said, the restlessness emanates from the heart. And it's the heart that is restless, and then the heart creates the restless mind. So it's really not the mind you're trying to calm, it's the heart you're trying to calm, which is a very interesting way to put it. And the heart in this sense, and that we have to make several distinctions here, the heart is, when we start talking about the chakras and other kinds of development, the heart is where likes and dislikes reside. And like, these are these aphoristic statements again, likes and dislikes. It sounds so simple, doesn't it? But if you accept, which of course we'll accept as the premise here, that in fact all of creation is a manifestation of Satchidananda, and that despite the apparent diversity that we are perceiving just in all the individuals in this room to begin with, we all have our own individual history, which we know. We have our separate bodies, we have our separate heritages, cultures, languages even in this situation. Nonetheless, we are all equally manifestations of the same infinite. And all of these differences that we see are entirely a result, well, let me say it differently, are what we see now is the result of having manifested on the spiritual plane, on the physical plane, and therefore of necessity taking one body, and of necessity that one body being the product of one man and one woman with all that they bring to it. Now, our destiny, our karmic destiny, and our individual consciousness is not created by the body. And this is where the scientists, even though they're going at this, they're never going to be able to figure out from analyzing the physiological cells what makes me so different from you. Because that happens on a level where the physical body is merely the vehicle to express that. This was Swamiji's reassuring comment once to parents. He said, you create the physical vehicle for the soul to express its destiny. But the parents create neither the soul nor the soul's destiny. They just create the vehicle through which that destiny can express. And so when you're just looking at the vehicle, you can get clues from the vehicle as to know what the soul's destiny might be. Urmila and I were having a discussion recently about the cultural influences on Indian women. And I was talking about when I first traveled to India in the context of giving lectures and classes, which ended up being some counseling and so on. I was quite confused as to what the right answer was to many of the issues, especially the women, brought to me, because I am exceedingly American, especially in terms of this sort of sense of individuality and equal rights and that sort of thing. Whereas many of the Indian women I were talking to were completely steeped in family culture, and the female serves the family even to her detriment. And my response was, no. And they would just, I mean, this one woman said to me, because I said something to her like, it's your life. She laughed. She didn't even bother to be angry. She just laughed. She said, what a silly thing to say. She says, my life belongs to my husband, my in-laws, my parents, and my children. She says, it's not mine. Now, that's not necessarily a bad answer, because rightly understood, that's a very generous, selfless, serviceful attitude. Now, if your mother-in-law is a bully and your husband is selfish and it's not working it's not serving anybody. You're not serving any truth. You're just serving people's limitations. And it becomes kind of dicey. But what I figured out, and it, I had to speak to some other Indian friends before I got this straight, is, oh, of course, this soul needed to be in a situation where the challenge between dharma and culture, between individual destiny and selfless service, they need those challenges. That's the karmic destiny that this person is going through. That's why she was born an Indian woman, you know, to be an adult in 2010. Right. Now, I, by contrast, I believe I fought that battle a long time ago. So I just got to be born in a very independent American fashion because I have other issues, gigantic, enormous issues, but just different. Different destiny that we're following. Now, all of this, these different destinies, really, if you think about it, come down to the likes and dislikes of the heart. Yogananda put the whole of the spiritual path in very simple terms. This was the science of religion, where he tried to make the idea of religion. That was the name of the first book he published. He didn't actually write it. He made an outline of the ideas and someone else wrote it, which is why Swami Kriyananda later rewrote the book and called it, he wanted to call it The Science of Religion, but the attorneys for Self-Realization Fellowship frowned upon that, and we decided we didn't want to go into it, so he called it God is for Everyone. But it was really a rewrite of that book, because the science of religion comes down to something that has nothing to do with dogma and theology. It's that every sentient being, from the worm to the master, is guided by two principles, which is the desire to avoid suffering and the desire to find happiness. Now, depending on the destiny, I mean, the dog defines happiness and suffering perhaps differently. The worm may define it differently. The awareness level varies enormously, and people's concept of what is suffering and what is happiness varies enormously. But we're always looking at those two realities. There was a time before we had this building, this church building, which we got in the fall of 1999. For 7 years prior, we had a storefront on California Avenue. It was actually a second story, so it wasn't really, didn't front on the street, but it was a commercial space. And it was in the back, upstairs in the back. It was actually really great because it was completely silent. When we first moved here, we were all extremely bothered by the traffic. Now I don't hear it anymore. Because prior to that, we had this cave, this windowless cave, but it was completely quiet. And at that time also, because everything was different, across the street from us, there was a nightclub, actually. It was called The Edge. It was more like a performance venue. And so they had lots of live bands and so on. And I'm sure they served drinks. I'm not really sure everything that went on. There was this big, the building's long since been torn down, but this big Quonset hut. And on certain nights, they might have had like under 21 nights or something like that where they didn't serve drinks. But sometimes I would come out of a class at 10 o'clock at night and I would be finishing and they would just be winding up over there. And sometimes the bass was so strong that I could actually feel it under the sidewalk. And I could feel this thump, thump. And one night in particular, I was riding my bicycle and I went back around and they were entering from the back, and it must have been teen night, because there were about 200 teenagers, all dressed in black, just because that's how everybody dressed, all dressed in black, eagerly lined up to get in to the Quonset hut, where the bass was so strong that I could feel it through the sidewalk. And they were so excited to be going in. And I thought, if you dragged me in there, I would feel like I'd been taken to hell, really. Just absolutely. And they were all eager to get in. You know, likes and dislikes. I was at the point where it would seem like suffering. They were at the point where it seemed like it was going to produce the greatest happiness. Now, whether they were correct or not was another issue, but that's the whole destiny of the soul. So, pardon me?
From,
say it again?
Did you say, In one of your talks, I think you said you wanted to, like, save them from going.
Yes, I did. That's right. I had this great desire. I'm a revolutionary by nature. I had this great desire to get up on a soapbox and say, no, no, children, don't go in, don't go in. I had forgotten that. But just a part of me knew that somehow that wouldn't be well received, so I just drove on. going back to where we were, but it's the likes and dislikes of the heart that move you one way or another. Isn't that so? And all of that is very individual. And then what happens, you see, once the heart makes up its mind that this is going to cause me happiness and this is going to cause me pain, then it triggers the thoughts that support it. And that's why when you talk to people about something that to you might be self-evidently destructive to them, if they're emotionally, and now we have to talk about emotion versus feeling, which is a very important distinction, if they're emotionally inclined to favor it, you can't reason them out of it. I mean, I'm sure you've had all those discussions with other people, which is more obvious than when other people are having them with you. But you've had discussions where there's just no way. And their own logic makes perfect sense to them. Because the heart is already committed. And this is the interesting physiology, that there is many gray matter, there's as much gray matter, I think is the phrase I heard, in the heart. It's got itself all organized. The scientists don't understand the subtleties of vibrations of consciousness, because that's not what they're working with yet. But it's vibrations of consciousness which get fixed as easily in the heart as they do in the head. But reason follows feeling. Now, this is very important to understand, because we sometimes think that the heart is superior to the mind, but it isn't. They're just very, very interrelated, because the heart can be unspeakably prejudiced. And if we just allow the heart to rule, sometimes that'll work, sometimes it won't. If we only follow the mind, what tends to happen is if we only follow the mind, we don't understand the part that feeling is playing in influencing the mind. So the key is not really heart and mind. The key is likes and dislikes. And the other key in it is the difference between emotion and feeling. Because when people are saying they want to follow the heart, they're really trying to say they're trying to follow intuition. But this gets just, again, all these things are a little dicey. Now, I have a new microphone system in which the cord is too short, so I have to make that work. So don't let me forget. Let me just try to say this. Part of the problem, what I'm about to write up here, is somewhat arbitrary in terms of the meaning of words, but it's just for the sake of our communication. As I've often said in these classes, English is not a good language for describing nuances of consciousness. Because the people who spoke English came from the West, and the Western orientation is more toward the things of the external world, and they just didn't bother to create words. The great thing about English is we just eat everybody else's language. We don't have any issues with it. I understand in France there's some kind of a board that determines whether or not words can be allowed into the language, but because they're a little more protective. In English, anybody's got a good word, we just take it. Chakra, guru, karma, it's all become English. Jungle, pajama, these are all words that we took from who knows where. Manana, it's all in there. And we just call it English now. Pizza, people think pizza is an American food. Spaghetti, cappuccino, where did these words come from? We all just use them casually. But we haven't, but when it comes to consciousness, we have to arbitrarily define. So from the point of view of the heart, there's two, I'm going to make the distinction here. There's something we would call feeling, and then something we would call emotion. Now, emotion isn't necessarily bad, it's just not quite the same as feeling. Because intuition, Master says, intuition, which is what we're really trying to find here, and I'll have to come in a minute to what intuition is. Intuition equals calm feeling, is how what Master described it. Because feeling is the fundamental, feeling, this is an English word, is the fundamental nature of consciousness, which is we have an experience, we don't just have an idea. we can talk about what it is to be happy, and we can define it, and we can discuss it, and we can do all sorts of things. But when it comes down to it, we understand happy because we feel happy. It's something that we experience. It's not just something that we abstract about. And when all other limiting conditions are taken away, what's left is pure feeling, the pure experience of existence is a feeling, and that feeling is bliss. And this we know, which is why we're never content without it. If we knew that there was no possibility of ever being perfectly happy, we wouldn't struggle, because we would just know it can't be done. I mean, I can stare at my size 8 foot and want to make it a size 5, but I know that no matter how long I stare at it, it's just not going to become a size 5, so I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. But if I feel agitated or upset or nervous about something, there's some very deep part of me, even without all this philosophy, that just knows that's not who I am. That's an aberration from what I could be. And this is the memory, this is the soul breaking through, the Atman, the eternal self breaking through, telling me that bliss is my true nature. And it's not just a thought, it's not just something cold and impersonal, it's a total experience, it's a feeling. So feeling is our true nature. And what when we're talking about the division between heart and mind in a negative way, a little bit the way Hannah was talking about the characteristics of where we all live right now, almost all of us live right now, what happens sometimes is people just get so mind-oriented. Well, yes, I know you just had a new baby, but you know the project has to be done. You know, and I hear that your grandmother's sick, but you had a lot of time off last week. You know, there's just no, there's more to life than just the things that we're dealing with. Feeling has to come into it. And so that disbalance away from the importance not only of what we're doing and thinking and accomplishing, but also how we feel while we're doing it, is that opposition between heart and mind that we're trying to overcome. But as I was saying, if we don't really understand this clearly, the determination to follow the heart can lead us into just as much of a mess as an over-reliance on mere intellectual things. So the difference between feeling and emotion would have to be, I'll put it like this. Feeling emanates really from the center of ourselves. And all of spiritual life and all of right thinking has to do with how deeply centered we are in ourselves. And I don't mean by this how inward looking we are, because if you can often be very inward looking, but you become even more isolated in doing it. But to be centered is not the same as to be self-centered in a negative sense. Self-concern is probably the right word. But all of us, because we're all meditators and we all understand this, we recognize the chakras, the spine, our sense of self emanates from the inside out. And in our wonderful English language, if you have a bad day, you'll say, I feel so off-centered all day. You know, I have to get centered again before I can act. I feel scattered. I need to pull myself together. And all of these images describe the fact that we know that when we just get spun out, that's another one, we get spun out, we've lost the grounding point. And when you begin to understand the anatomy of yoga, you get the chakras, you get the flow of energy in the center of the spine, you get conscious focus at the spiritual eye, and all of those different things, all of which lead to living from your inside out. The image of it, the picture of a tree is a perfect way to think about it, with all its different branches like this. There's this incredible tree that is in the center of our courtyard, this big elm, which is right by Master's Shrine. I mean, it's always been there. It's just an enormous tree. You'll be way in another part of the courtyard there, and you'll look up and you'll realize that you're actually still following one of those branches. So that tree has an enormously powerful trunk, and it must have very, very deep roots. It's very, very solid. But with all of that, it extends way out like this, you know, just huge like this. And it has all these tiny little leaves, and, you know, and it supports so many different things. But if it became weak here, then all of this would fall apart. Recently, outside the window of the room where I live, in the house that I live in, there was this gigantic tree that was always there. And in the summer, I would often sleep outside on the balcony, and that tree was over me. And then I went on a long trip, and I came back, and it was gone. It was so shocking that it was gone. But Chidambar, who's an arborist and knows trees, told me that the roots were very weak, and that he knew how to tell. And it was such a big tree that it was just dangerous. It had to be taken down because it could have crashed on people or buildings or something like that. Because without strength at the center, if you extend yourself too far, there's no solidity. There's no continuity. Emotion is when your feelings become disconnected from the source. Okay, feeling disconnected from the source. And the emotion can be exuberant, happy, you know, you're really having a great time, or emotion can be devastating. And feeling can be positive and feeling can be negative. It's not like feeling is only good and emotion is only bad. It's a question of whether or not, in the case of emotion, the feeling has become so strong that it's become a self-definition in itself, and not merely an expression from your source, but the very definition of who you are. Okay? And this can happen. I am now a mother. I have a baby that I love. Being a mother is what I've always wanted to do. Having children is just—it just gives me purpose. It gives me meaning. I remember I asked my mother, when she was about 70, probably the same age I am now, I just talking to her, "Mom, what was the happiest time of your life?" "Oh," she said, "when your children were small." Yeah, yeah, you understand that? Yeah.
She's saying the same thing to me. "Oh, I look at a picture, you're so cute, and you was me. Like, what can I do now?"
Yeah, what can I do now? I'm just big and lunky and not so cute anymore. Exactly. I was out. My nephew, who used to be quite small, is now quite large. I mean, he's not only full grown, but he's a big man. And I remember being out with him, and then there was this family over, and there was darling little boys, you know, they were playing with him. I wanted to drag him over and say, "This is what's going to happen, you know. Enjoy it, but, you know, don't get attached to it. This is what's going to happen." Exactly. So it seems like the feeling, you love it, but you disconnect from the source. And then what happens? What happens when this goes away? Where are you then?
That's what I was telling her all the time.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Where are you going to be then? Mm-hmm. But it depends on whether or not a person has a connection with the source at all, or whether just simply the likes and dislikes of the heart gallop along and confuse you. Now, it doesn't... See, some yogis make a mistake, and therefore, I'll have children, but I won't really get involved, and I won't really love them, you know, which is a mistake that people make. They think to be uninvolved is the same as being unattached. But that's as much a like and dislike of the heart as anything, because generally that comes from the fear of being hurt. And fear of being hurt is not, that's just a like and dislike of the heart. That's just reasoning it out. And so the heart is scared, so it has this fantastic justification in the spiritual path. I just won't get attached. But that's just saying, I'm going to just protect myself and not be hurt. But feeling, especially feelings of perfect selfless love, is divine. And so you don't get anywhere. This is the Gita. You don't get out of action by inaction. If the fear is of being hurt, you don't protect yourself from that. You don't get over it by protecting, by not acting. I won't love. Because the decision not to love is just as binding as the decision to love. It's just the two sides of it. Are you following all that? So what we're dealing with now, when we're talking about the heart and the mind, is what we really want to be following is calm feeling. But we have to learn the difference between emotion and feeling as we're defining it here. Okay, Deepak.
How do we know what is coming from the mind?
Well, see,
is that where the intuition?
I don't think, from my point of view, and this is the gospel according to Asha, and I always like to make a distinction between something that I've just made up and something that I actually know is endorsed by others. I have never found it helpful to think of the mind and the heart as separate. I know everybody thinks about the mind and the heart as separate. Many people do. But I can't get any clarity out of that. Because one, I can't tell the difference. And also, perhaps it's just because I'm such a mentally active person. I don't know. I can't just tell my mind to stop. And I also have found my mind to be extremely useful to me because it helps me discern the difference between emotion and feeling. So the reason I'm trying to get this clear is it's not a question of the mind and heart. It's a question that reason is always governed by what your, I'll use the word feeling is what Master said, but let's say emotion. Reason is always governed by the inclination of your feelings in the matter. So what you have to learn to do is you have to be able to discern where is this feeling coming from? Not do I have a feeling, but where is it coming from? And is it merely just my likes and dislikes influencing me to go in a direction that I really want to go? Now, is this easy? No, it's not easy. But at least when you think of it like this, you say, okay, I feel this way. So the question is, why do I feel this way? And the question is, where will this feeling take me from? Now, I'll say another part about this, which is really all about intuition here, which is the ability to follow intuition, which is what we're talking about, is progressive. It's not an all or nothing situation. And what we're trying to follow when we're following intuition is we're trying to become more and more motivated from our actual own inner self. And so it partly depends on where you start. Like, for example, because we were talking about cultural differences, if you've never had a chance, and one shortcoming I have observed in the raising of women in India is that often their lives just roll along. They're propelled through education, often to a very high level. Then often as soon as education is finished, marriage is arranged. Soon after marriage, then comes children. And then about the age of 40 is the first time that they stop and ask, where do I fit in all of this? By which point, they're so entangled, it's like it's very difficult, even when you have an answer, what to do about it. And you're not asked, I mean, I'm just speaking in very broad terms, you're not asked as you go along, what am I really moved by? I vividly remember this lovely Indian woman. As it happened, she was very petite and very delicate. And she was visiting here. I believe she was in Canada going to school, and she was getting a PhD. And I asked her, what is your PhD? In petroleum engineering, she said. If I have ever seen anyone who is not a petroleum engineer, I was looking at her, and I thought, my gosh, who in your family chose that for you? You know, and there she was getting her, and she'll just end up being a petroleum engineer, and at some point it will cross her mind that this never emanated from inside her. So forgetting cultural India, it just happens to be a good example. The first step is to make any decisions at all from any level of your likes and dislikes. Instead of just being a passive instrument in the hands of others, to even stand back and say, I don't like chickpeas, I have never liked chickpeas. And it's not a very high issue, but at least you're saying for yourself, I don't like it. You know, I don't like the red dress my mother always put me in. You know, I don't like this house that my husband picked out for me. I don't like the design of the kitchen. The beginning of it may be quite self-centered and not very nice. But at least it's the beginning of finding out what are my actual likes and dislikes. Now, because the inner voice, so to speak, has as many levels as anything else. And the inner voice can be quite misleading in terms of your ultimate happiness. But if you've never even heard it, it's better to have it be asserting itself with great selfishness than for you to be completely deaf to its voice. So first we have to know we have an inner voice, then we have to begin to listen to it, and then we have to begin to discern among the many competing inner voices which ones actually represent wisdom. And the only way I know how to do that is to get your mind activated and to be actually reflecting, you know, in a very intelligent and soft and open way, but reflecting upon these various feelings that I have and where they might come from and where they might lead, instead of just declaring, well, I feel this, it must be right. Although I still hasten to say, if you've never done anything according to what you feel, it's better to just run wild for a while. But ideally, you want to move into actual intuition, not just emotions, where you're still just boinging back and forth. Okay, comments, questions, thoughts? Does that make sense? Yes, Olga.
Comment. I mean, it totally makes sense now, because for the last 1.5 year, I've become concerned with my self-concern. Because I'm selfish.
It gets complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah, that I left the dog in a can right now.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know what that puppy is doing there.
Uh-huh.
Is it really selfish? Because I really wanted to go to the tours.
Right.
I mean, it's not that I'm so...
Well, let me put this a little bit in perspective. The desire for spiritual advancement is not the same as the likes and dislikes of the ego. Because that desire, which will dissolve all desires, is what they call a desireless desire. You know, this is again just English. But the longing for God is the longing to escape completely from the pendulum swing of likes and dislikes.
Okay, because I start to create a guilt in my...
Yes, it does.
Okay.
So then guilt, now see, and I don't like to analyze this too far, but it can be analyzed very far. Guilt is, oh dear, people are going to disapprove of me, I'm not really doing. Oh dear, if I follow this course of action, I may lose certain situations that I presently enjoy. I may lose relationships, I may lose respect in a certain place, I may lose convenience, I may lose financial support, I may lose all sorts of things. Now, those are likes and dislikes, but if your movement toward, let's say, toward higher consciousness is actual intuition, and then that intuition is made nervous because all these likes and dislikes start playing into it. And this gets very complicated, and it can't be answered theoretically. In the Gita, it's very simple. A dharma is a dharma until it is replaced by higher dharma. And so that's when I'm talking about inner voice. You know, I may have a strong gut-level inner voice that if I do that, it's going to jeopardize a relationship that's very important to me. But I might have a strong call from here or even from the heart to go in a direction that's going to jeopardize this. So this chakra is screaming at me and this chakra is whispering to me. And that's why it can't just be about feeling. You have to be able to discern among those many different inner voices. I was at a particular point in my life where I was in a tumultuous situation that I was hoping would resolve in a certain way, and then I had one of the few times in my life where I really felt like God actually spoke to me. God spoke to me and said, this is what you have to do. There was a second of great elation because I really felt it was divine intuition, followed immediately by the realization of what that meant in my life, that many things I was attached to I was going to lose. So I was joyful for a split second, and then I was devastated because all the likes and dislikes in me had now been contradicted by a higher intuition. But I was not happy, and I was not happy for a very, very long time, but I had to follow it. Because it was true intuition. It was actually calm feeling, and all the rest of it was just emotion. But boy, that emotion was making a lot of noise. So which part of my heart did I follow? That's why I don't find heart and mind quite as useful, because it was all my heart. It was just all the different parts of my heart. So a crossroads, we very often hit a crossroads where emotions are contradicted by higher intuition. And we have to be able to be calm enough, clear-minded enough, practiced enough. How do we tell the difference? Well, generally speaking, by making a whole lot of really big mistakes and then just realizing in retrospect, oh,
so
I see what's in.
Saints and sinners
who never gave up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and oftentimes it's very interesting. People will say, I knew I shouldn't have done it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew I should have stopped the wedding before it happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew I shouldn't have whatever. So and you make those mistakes, and then the next time, but you also have to understand, and you know, you raise the question of what do I do? I think almost any decision is fine. I mean, I know that sounds odd in the light of all of this, but life just has a way of unfolding, and we imagine that every single thing, that we're in charge, that our little process is actually the decision-making factor, but it just seems to me that the karmic trajectory pushes us. Our job is to be as conscious as possible, but it's much more important to make the best of wherever we find ourselves than it is to spend all our time trying to manipulate the world to give us the perfect circumstances. Because all of these circumstances are just like that in eternity. But the consciousness that we have in the midst of it is ours forever. So we tend to put cosmic importance on the trivial, wrap ourselves into just a snarl of fear and anxiety and self-concern, which we think is helpful, when in fact, if we were just cheerfully went along and just as Larry said, how can I help?
Mm-hmm.
How can I help? How can I help? That's, you have that forever.
Mm-hmm.
Circumstances come and go and just don't really make a lot of difference. You can mess up any circumstance with wrong attitude. And you can retrieve any with right attitude. So it's the right attitude that you're really looking for, rather than the right conditions. And realistically, sometimes we simply do not have the strength to transcend our conditions, and therefore conditions also have to be changed. Nothing is a straight line on the spiritual path. Does that make sense? Does that help with your question? And yes, self-concern is an issue, and we just have to work on it. But often we find ourselves in circumstances that just like, ooh, there's no clear answer here, is there? Sometimes we just have to hang out until... I was in a situation, actually it was when I moved to Ananda. I had been following Ramakrishna for a long time, a few years. I never took initiation or anything, it never crossed my mind to do so. But I was dedicated and I went to their temples a lot. And then I met Swami Kriyananda, which was just cut across everything else. And so I wanted to move to Ananda. However, being part of Ananda meant taking on this line of masters, and I was quite dedicated to Ramakrishna, who's respected by this line, but it's not the same line. But I knew that I needed to follow Kriyananda at that point, and I simply couldn't resolve the other question. But I realized I couldn't resolve the other question because I didn't have the intuition. I didn't have the clarity of intuition to know. And if I just sat there and waited for clear intuition, I would never get it. Because what was I doing to clear my intuition? Whereas I knew if I learned from Swami Kriyananda, it would clarify my intuition. And then when my intuition cleared, I would have the answer to this question. Do you follow that? So sometimes we hang out doing nothing, waiting for absolute clarity, when we'll never get it. The phrase that Swami uses is, energy has its own intelligence. And if you simply put out energy in some direction, then it begins to clarify things because things happen to you. And so the fear of making a mistake is often a much worse attitude than any mistake you're going to make. Because if you sincerely go forward, because it seemed like a good idea at the time, it'll either turn out to be a good idea or it'll teach you. For me, I went to Ananda, and I lived there for a year, and I said to Ramakrishna and to Yogananda, this is your problem. This is your problem. I said, I can't figure this out. You sort it out. I lived at Ananda for a year. I woke up one morning, and I said, of course, this is the path you belong to. No aspersions on Ramakrishna. He was just taking care of me till I got here. I learned later there's an actual word for it. It's called Upaguru. where it can be a true guru, but for you, it's just a temporary. But it was like, after a year of behaving as if, putting myself into it without reservation, then I had a clearer sense of intuition. You see, and this is again, reason and feeling. I didn't have a clear feeling about it, but my reason said, this is a good thing to do, and it will help me clarify my feeling in time. So I just used the two of them together. If I had just followed feeling, I was completely at sea. I didn't know what to do. Although, in fact, the feeling that I should be where Kriyananda was stronger than the confusion. So feeling was part of it. Then reason came in and helped me sort out the confusion. Does that all make sense? There has to be both. A very few people. But even I watched Swami many, many, many times. He would have a clear feeling about something, but then he would always also support it with ideas and reason. And he trained us that way. He would feel that something was right. The phrase was, come over for tea at 4 o'clock and we'll talk about it. So then he would invite people over and we'd sit there and he would. And he never presented it as, I have an intuition, or Master came to me in meditation, although sometimes I think he actually did. But Swami would just say, this seems like a good idea, what do you think? And then we'd all sort of talk about it. And often in talking about it, we could sort out between the likes and dislikes and get to that point of calm feeling where we knew what was going to be. And it wasn't just reason, pros and cons. It was a little bit of both, you know. And then we just sort of reach a point where I was in one meeting. It was about a 3-hour meeting where this big project was proposed. And at the beginning, Swami said no. And then there was hours, in this case, of discussion. At the end of the time, Swami said yes. And someone said, well, should we stop and meditate on it? And Swami says, well, we have been. Meaning we've been having an intelligent, calm, impartial discussion. And in other words, we've been getting centered, he said. And Swami completely reversed himself as a result of the discussion. Even though he'd come in quite opposed at the beginning, he was quite supportive in the end. Yes?
You know, along those same lines of reason and feeling, you were saying that, you know, related to this, you were saying that when you don't do your spiritual practices, you feel irritable. And when you do, you know, you feel like much more centered, which mm-hmm. of course very much the way I feel. Mm-hmm. And so the decision that I've made for myself is, you know, even if it like creates some inconvenience for somebody else within reason, you know, my first job is to take care of myself spiritually. Because then, you know, my energy is going to be better. I'm just going to be of more benefit to everybody around me in every situation. Within reason, I mean, if it's a life and death, you know, that's where the reason part comes in. You know, if it's going to create chaos, then that's a different story. But
there's another
primarily.
There's another aphorism of Ananda's, which is, where there is dharma, there is victory. Some of these phrases, which I've lived with all these years, which are just so short, I can't tell you how many times that has resolved a dilemma for me. Victory meaning triumph of the spirit. If I violate dharma, nothing is ever going to work out. And dharma may be that I have to choose my spiritual life over other people's preferences. But if I choose other people's preferences and violate my higher dharma, it's never going to work out. Now, that doesn't mean that your life won't turn into chaos. You have to understand what victory actually is. It won't be that you'll necessarily get what you want. But it will be that in the end, the spirit will be victorious. And so that, you know, that years of experience with that, I just hold the line to dharma. I can't, even when I'm tempted, I just can't because I know it's not going to work. I mean, it even comes down to somebody gives you an extra 12 cents at the market, you know, and you're all the way out to your car before they've given you, you realize they've given you 12 cents more. You just have to go back in and give them the 12 cents back because it's not yours. And it just, even, that's a small example, but you just can't because you realize, why would I shoot myself in the head? Yes, exactly. And if you know that if you give up your spiritual practices and you're being called to them, even if the people around you are quite upset, you will never end up having what you want if you allow that fear to dominate. And boy, is that a tough teaching.
Exactly.
That is a really tough teaching.
So I
Now, being strategic and being diplomatic is not the same as just being nice. You can be strategic and diplomatic. I mean, think about this. We'll take a break in just a moment. Rajasi Janakananda's wife, Rajasi Master's most advanced male disciple, she was mentally unbalanced. A year after they got married, she had some kind of an illness, and for the rest of her life, she was mentally unbalanced. I mean, major mental unbalance. And at first, she was interested in the spiritual path, and then she took an intense and absolute aversion to it and just literally flew into a rage over the idea that he was involved. So for all his life, he had to keep it from her. So he would go into his office early in the morning, and he meditated in his office. He did not meditate at home. And he didn't come to see Master quite as much as he wanted to, and when he did, he had to carefully arrange it, mostly keeping it from her, because there was just no way that he could involve her in it. So he was strategic and diplomatic, but he did not give up what he was supposed to do. So there's no point in flaunting it if somebody is furious. Another friend of mine, her husband's not very enthusiastic, she keeps her whole altar in a little box. He goes off to work, she opens the little box. Keeps peace in the home, she still has her way. And so it's a balance point. But another example, this couple at Ananda, this was like in the 70s. They'd been married for about 7 years. I think they had children. And the woman finally decided she couldn't be with him anymore. And she said, and we were talking to Swami at the table about this couple breaking up. They left Ananda a long time ago. I don't even know who they were now. And someone was telling Swami, who knew them better, whenever she would sit to meditate, he would turn the television on really, really loud to try to disturb her meditation. And Swami said, she put up with that for 7 years? He said, I would have left after 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, absolutely not. I would never have done that. You know. So there's just lots of different... Master said that to Prabhu Das, I guess his name was his cousin. One of the marriages that was arranged for Yogananda that he refused to accept was to some beautiful woman. And the feast, remember it's on the autobiography, the feast was all arranged. And he said, you're just upset, my relatives, you're just upset because you're not going to have the feast. So let's just have this woman marry my cousin. I mean, to Americans that sounds really weird. But in the context of India, it was very reasonable. If she's suitable for me, she'll be suitable for him. So he married her. In 1936, Yogananda goes back and he finds that his cousin is a prisoner in his own home because his wife is such a volatile nag that he's just completely subservient to her moods and he tiptoes around. So Yogananda goes to the wife, and this is all an autobiography, goes to the wife and he said, I have some right to speak because you were supposed to be my wife. I wanted you to know if you treated me like you're treating him, I would have left after 15 minutes and gone to the Himalayas. You know, and if a woman is abandoned, she doesn't get to marry again. I mean, it's over. He said, I would never have put up with that. So there's all these, you know, just different nuances of it.
She's lucky.
Well, she was, and apparently, I think it helped a little. Let's take a break, and then we can come back and talk about anything else. We can go in another direction. Why don't we talk about where we need to go next. I know the write-up for this class was extremely poignant about suffering and anguish and overcoming it and all of that. So we haven't gone there yet, which we can go there. Questions or comments or thoughts or directions? Yes, Hannah.
I just love how you've explained, like how Master said, that reason follows feeling and that not thinking of the heart and mind as separate.
Mm-hmm.
And that just feels so much more.
And I think it's a good idea, too.
I think it's a good idea, and it feels really, it's just always better to be all-inclusive and finding
harmonious
balance of everything working together and not drawing divisions or separation.
Exactly.
And also, I wanted to ask, if reason follows feeling, then really, in truth, truth, no matter how we're talking about it, the mind and the heart can never be separated. It's just a matter of if we're, and I think this is why I said, and a lot of people talk about going more into your heart, and everything you talked about up there, the difference between feeling and emotion, living in intuition, or the likes and dislikes. So it's just a matter of not if the heart and mind are separate, because really they're completely interconnected, whether we're realizing it or not. It's just a matter of if we're coming from feeling, or if we're unconscious that the heart is affecting our reason and we're just coming from likes and dislikes.
That's perfect. That's exactly right. You followed it all the way through. I'll add some pictures to help that make that more vivid. When I first came to Ananda, I was raised in an intellectual family. That side of life is somewhat natural to me. I mentioned in a sermon I was giving at some point about how I was always school smart, and school was really just about intellect, where I was raised, how I was raised. I remember when a girl who'd been raised at Ananda Village and had gotten up to the eighth grade, and we didn't have a high school then, so she went to the local high school. And immediately she was on the honor roll and all that sort of thing. And I just casually said to her, "Well, congratulations, you know, I see you're on the honor roll." She laughed. She said, "It's effortless." She said, "When I was in school here, it wasn't just whether I got the math problems right. It was what kind of a mood I was in when I was answering the test, and whether I was helping the other one who didn't know as much, and whether I loved math or did it under duress." She said, "I go to high school, all they care about is the answers." She says, it's nothing. I'm using this much of myself, whereas here I was being educated, you know, to be a whole person. But so I was raised like that. Not that my family was very supportive and all of that. We weren't geniuses at dealing with our feelings, but it was basically a healthy atmosphere. But when I got to Ananda, I was just very mental, very mind-oriented. And just to put it like that, I was put into the kitchen right away because I had a great interest in nutrition and health food and so on like that. But I was a terrible cook. And Swamiji taught me to cook over one long weekend, which is a different story. But at a certain point afterwards, he said this to me, "You were so mental, you couldn't even tell what the food tasted like." Which I realized afterwards that was right. If it was good for me, it tasted good. Now, in truth, I actually do like healthy food better than junk food. It's just a preference I have. But he was right. I never actually tasted it because I was so busy knowing it was good for me. My thoughts so dominated all other experience that I actually didn't have other experiences.
So how would you decipher that if you were speaking to someone? Because that's what I meant by living in the heart versus living in the mind.
Uh-huh.
So like, how would you explain that experience? Sorry, I didn't mean
to. No, it's all right. I prefer a dialogue.
Yeah.
So how would I explain that? Meaning, how would I help someone else come out of that?
Yeah.
Well, the first is they have to be interested in coming out of it.
Yeah.
If you're trying to impose it upon them, do something else. Generally speaking, experiences have to be created somehow. But if a person is genuinely interested in coming out of it, the way I usually talk to...
How would you describe it with the English language?
Describe?
Like how you were knowing the food was so good for you and that was kind of living more.
It was just living according to what this is a positive thing, therefore I like doing this, rather than what kind of experience am I actually having in this. I don't know how you would explain it to someone who wasn't. He told me afterwards. He didn't tell me at the time. If he told me at the time, I would have said, "What?" So he didn't try to explain it to me until after I had learned to cook and had awakened the capacity to discern, you know, what flavorings were needed and what was required. Because prior to that, even when I tried to make things taste good, I had no intuition. I had no connection to my feeling about things. He taught me to cook entirely by intuition. It was the first thing in my life I ever learned to do intuitively. that, because I've come so close to the edge, I'll just tell you the story. I'm cooking for the whole community at the time when nobody had kitchens. This was up at what was the old retreat then. 30 people lived up there. Nobody had kitchens. They all had to eat the food I cooked. The food I cooked was healthy and terrible as a rule. And vaguely somewhere, it was healthy. I mean, like, this is what prompted it. Organic is good, homegrown is good. During the winter months, and economy is good, economical. During the winter months, what we had was Jerusalem artichokes, sunchokes, they call them. It looks a little bit like ginger. They're awful. I've tried them in every possible way that you could cook them, and they're really awful. I would eat them grated up like a carrot, and they were okay. Cooked, they're just terrible. I recently was in New Zealand with this fantastic Indian woman who cooked fantastic food. She cooked Jerusalem artichokes, and they were still terrible. So they can't be made to taste good as far as I'm concerned. So there was Jerusalem artichokes and kale. Kale was not the trendy vegetable it is now. Kale was way out on the lunatic fringe of health. But both kale and Jerusalem artichokes grew through the fall and into the winter. I served kale and Jerusalem artichokes 2 out of 3 meals. It was awful. And finally, those people went to Swami and said, basically, we're dying. You have to do something about this. So by then I was beginning to get that there was more involved than just whether it was healthy. That, you know, there were just people had feelings about food that needed to be respected. And then I started trying to cook well, but I just couldn't. I just couldn't make anything taste good. I just couldn't figure out. Even when I'd follow a recipe, it wouldn't come out good. Isn't that funny? It's just like my vibration was so off. So Swami said to me something like, you know, that dish you made last week, it was a little bland, he said. He's so tactful. I said, yes, sir, I tried so hard and it still came out bland. And so he saw that I was receptive, you see. If I had been defensive at that point, the conversation would have stopped. But I indicated to him that I was now trying. And then he said, again, very gently, in fact, actually, most of what you make is a little bland. And then again, he said, perhaps I could help you. Oh, Swamiji, could you? Like that. And then as it happened, this man, whose name then was Swami Nirmalananda, he's now Abbot George of this small Catholic church somewhere in New Mexico or Arizona. American man, he was a robust, let's call him robust. He was an enthusiastic trencherman. He was a friend of Swami Kriyananda's, a disciple of Ananda Mohima. He came to visit for the weekend. And Swami said, why don't you come and we'll cook together for the time that he's visiting. So he came and we did 3 meals a day for 3 days. And when I first came to learn to cook, I came with a notebook and a pen like this. And I'm standing on the side and I'm ready. I'm going to, because this is how I think, you know, I'm going to write it all down. I'm going to study it. Then I'm going to know how to cook. So I start like trying to write it all down, and Swami's a little of this, a little of that. Oops, that's too much. Then we'll throw this in, you know. Oh, so that's not, you know, just completely like this. I'm trying to write this down. Imagine. Finally, I had the sense to just put the pen and paper down. And what I mostly did was just kind of wash dishes. Occasionally, I'd chop a vegetable or something like that, and Swami just did this. And we cooked 3 meals, and the very last meal, Seva was there and Satya and a few others, and we were just very informally. My pictures, we were all sort of stretched out on the floor. There wasn't a lot of furniture. And we sort of said, well, what will we have for dinner? And we sort of agreed we'd have fruit salad. And Seva said, well, I'll cook it. And Swami said, fine, go ahead. And then he said, oh, no, very exaggerated. Oh, no, he said, I'm teaching Asha how to cook like that. So we have to do it. So we got up and we made the fruit salad. Monday morning, I knew how to cook. I could just feel it. He had connected. He'd connected my mind and my feeling. And from that point on, I've just always known how to do it without any reasonable part, some part of me. Now, and part of the reason I could do it was because cooking had absolutely no value to me. So it didn't make any difference whether I did it well or badly. There was no self-esteem at stake. In the family that I was raised in, and I was only in my 20s then, so I was much closer to that influence, who cared how you cooked? It was how you thought, how you wrote, how you the grades you got in school, who cared how you cooked, it was just food. But so I didn't have any self-esteem at stake, and I was just able to move right into it. Now, how could I possibly have explained to that one? How could anybody have explained that to me? I had to just, you know, I was cooking every day, 3 meals a day, 6 days a week, like this and like this and like this, and getting all this, you know, there's a whole lot going on. So a lot of it is timing. I read recently that even the guru doesn't actually teach you anything. He just makes you aware of what you're about ready to understand. So that's unfortunately just a lot of it. So good luck. When you figure out how to explain that to someone, you come and you tell me. What was the rest of the question that you had there? Did I lose a piece of it?
No, that was really helpful.
Yeah, that's really helpful. You just know when you know.
Yeah.
Until then, you just don't. There was something, it was also interesting, this is just by the way, since I'm in the story of cooking. So after that, I cooked for Swami a lot. I cooked for him personally, I often cooked, this was before he had a housekeeper, later he had a full-time cook. I often cooked when there were guests, you know, that sort of thing. After he died, which was now only a few years ago, I still can, but it's like, well, I'm not even sure that I can. It was almost like as soon as he died, it went away. I still can sort of understand food, and I can kind of vaguely know what to do, but it was like a siddha that I just had to have for a period of time, and it was related only to serving him personally, and then when it was gone, it was gone. Because now I cook, and I just sort of like, it's like I sort of know it could be better than this, but there's just nothing in me that cares. Whereas before, it wasn't that I just cooked well for him, it's that I could always cook well. Now I can't even do it. Odd, isn't it? So there's many, 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 many mysteries. We just don't know what we're dealing with a lot of the time. Huh. So, any questions? Yes, Larry. Oh,
this
I just.
Kind of unrelated.
Well,
I'm interrupting. Sorry.
No, you were. Okay, go ahead. Oh, I knew. I had a couple of other things related that I wanted to say, but go ahead and you say what you're going to say
just
first.
Just quickly. It seems to me that sometimes when you're around somebody who's really, really spiritually advanced or
uh-huh.
so in touch with the divine and just being close to them, or something can get transmitted to
absolutely.
You, it takes you to a higher place.
Pure magnetism.
Yes.
That story about Swami teaching me to cook, I wrote the stories about Master, I mean about Swamiji, the book, Swami Kriyananda as we've known him, I tried to put that story in that book about 3 or 4 or 5 different times. I could never universalize it, because the purpose of the stories in that book is to learn what's possible for everyone, not have people think, oh, aren't you lucky and aren't I unlucky? And I could never make that story work. I was lucky. I had the karma to be in a certain place at a certain time, and I just don't know how to universalize that one. I've tried and tried. Transference of magnetism, all that stuff. It's in what I'm writing now. I don't know if it'll last. I tried one more time. There was a context in which it seemed like it might work, because yes, it was a transference of magnetism, consciousness, other sorts of things, which of course is perfectly possible without physical proximity.
If you experience it, it's unmistakable.
It's when you experience it, it's unmistakable. That's exactly right. But I've never been able to make that story work. So I tell it because it's entertaining, but I can't write it yet. Katerina, you were going
to
ask.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could
Oh, the multiple voices. Ah, yes, the multiple voices. You know, the worst, the most difficult thing that I've seen people do is to be at war with themselves. Mm-hmm. And even that's why the heart and mind dichotomy is one that I'm not fond of. Everybody comes at the spiritual path from their own orientation. I come from having had to fight my way through a lot of being at war with myself. And that's why I said I could learn to cook, because it wasn't important to me. Anything that feels important has, I'll use the past tense, I'll try. The past tense is not completely accurate, but it's more accurate than the present tense. Anything that involved something I thought was valuable, I was always fighting with myself. I need to be excellent, I need to do it right. Everything I do matters. and you're always messing it up. Why don't you get it right? And it was just, it was gridlock. It was just constant gridlock, because no matter what came up, there was a simultaneous inner voice that was anxious about the perfection of it. And this is, of course, a real factor in the way a lot of us are brought up. Yeah, and especially when excellence is external. And excellence is not, oh, look what a good attitude you're having as your world collapses. Look what a mess you made of things, and look how cheerful you are in the face of failure. I mean, we're not reinforced for that as a rule. We're only reinforced for getting it right. So our values are just completely twisted up. So the way you have to deal with your inner voices is everything about the spiritual path is increasing awareness. And it's a very simple word. Swamiji once even suggested we call our whole teaching, you know, something like greater awareness. It as a tagline, it really didn't necessarily work, but it really is the truth. Because what you really want to be aware of is what's really moving you. It's just as simple as that. And you want to be aware of what is the call of superconsciousness and what is the repeated litany of subconsciousness. Subconscious in the way we use it spiritually. Subconscious is that which you have already done, which is not going to take you to greater growth, spiritually speaking, not professionally or anything like that, but just spiritually speaking. Subconscious is the habit. Whatever has come into me before, this is the system I use and this is what I do. Superconscious is the part of you that's saying, oh, we're going to get bigger. And so the battleground is always between that which is going to make you bigger and that which is going to keep you just the same as you are. And it can't be defined objectively sometimes. It's just the fear of speaking up may cause you to become rude and selfish, but growth is in not being afraid to speak up. And it doesn't matter at that point who's mad at you. It still is expansive for you not to be afraid to speak. But once you're not afraid to speak, being a little bit considerate of others may now be expansive for you. So the only way you can understand that is you have to become aware of what's really moving me. Is that fear speaking? Is that intuition speaking? And secondly, I guess the other way to discern among your inner voices, we are always asking for God to give us a clear sign as to what we're supposed to do about things about which God does not care. And so we do this long, complicated, endless prayer, this anguishing, why don't you tell me? You know, should I go through the green door or should I go through the purple door? I like the purple door, but you know, I always go through the purple door, so I want to go through the green door, and green reminds me, and we just go like this, tell me, tell me. And God is just like, you know, buffing his nails, if he had such a thing, you know, just waiting for you to ask a question that he has an answer to. Like the question, how can I serve? Who can I help? How can I grow closer to you? Oh, now there's a question I can answer. Go through the green door, go through the purple door, who cares? Because you can be just as selfish through the purple door as you can through the green door. And you can be just as expansive through the green door as you can through the purple door. Depends on what you do afterwards. So when you're not getting clarity, I found this out, when you're not getting clarity, it's almost always because you're asking the wrong question. And I remember a circumstance, this I did put into the book. I was so torn between two different decisions and I just couldn't decide. And I was going around in circles. And that was when I said to Swami, it's so hard to know God's will. And that was when he said to me, no, it's not, just like that. No, it's not. I mean, just almost like so casual. And I went home and I thought, it's really hard for me to know. And then I thought to myself very deeply, why is it so hard for me to know? I said, because you don't want to know. Simple as that. I really didn't want the answer because I knew what the right answer was and I didn't like it. So it was much more pleasant just to be afraid. I mean, just to go in circles and act about how sincere I was and do this whole thing, because then I didn't have to. So, but I didn't have to face the fact that I was afraid. In my personal life, because of the way I'm constituted, it's always fear. Confusion is always the root of all confusion for me is fear. The root of all unhappiness for me is fear. Maybe that's true for everyone, I don't know. It's always true for me. So whenever I'm unhappy or confused, I stop dealing with the issue. And my prayer becomes different. Why am I so afraid? And when I really ask that question, why am I so afraid? God stops buffing his nails and starts actually answering me, because now there's something we can work with. Oh, well, and you have obvious things that I'm afraid of. I'm afraid my house will burn down. I'm afraid I'll be homeless on the street. I'm afraid nobody will love me. I'm afraid I'll never get anything I want. Oh, no, those are valid things to be afraid of. I mean, and this is coming into that other part of this. You know, the tenderness of the heart is not a joke. It's not something that can just be pushed aside. And when you have the courage, when we have the courage to actually be where we actually are, with this, with all that fear and heartache, a tremendous amount of our running in circles is a desperate effort to keep that from happening, from ever having to really sit with that. And that's what causes us to chase our tails all the time, because we just want to do anything, but actually. And this brings me back to what I was remembering, Hannah, that I didn't finish. One of the things I liked about Swami Kriyananda and enjoyed all through the decades I knew him was that he was so intelligent. Just so, and I love that. It's just everybody has their biases. I love intelligent conversation. I love clear thinking. I love interesting, expansive ideas. I would have followed him if he were in Mon and never said a word. But it was just nice that he was like that. But I could tell that his intelligence was entirely different than mine. I was an intellectual, and he was intelligent. There was quite a difference. And he could just see things that I could never... I can't tell you how many times a whole group of us would come to him with an insoluble problem, and in a couple of minutes, he would just solve it. And he would solve it simply and obviously, but none of us, and we were not slouchers. We just couldn't figure it out, and he could always figure it out. Always. There was always a solution. He was very super conscious.
His heart was calm.
His heart was calm. And he wasn't compelled or limited by likes and dislikes. And I finally realized, I looked at him one day, and when he was young, he was like Arjuna with the bow. And if you looked at the plane of his body, his heart was a little bit in advance of his brain. When I looked at the plane of my body, it was like that. It was like I actually was pushing on life from my brain, and Swami was meeting life with his heart. And I realized the clarity of his mind was the courage of his heart. He just wasn't afraid. If it was true, he wanted to know it. And he would deal with the implications. He wasn't afraid. And I was terrified of 1,000,000,000 options, and he simply wasn't. So that's where gradually it all came to me. Oh, courage of the heart, that's what's required. Now, I have come to know, I didn't know this earlier, I've come to know in my life that a great deal of my personality has been trying to stay ahead of certain heartbreaks, mostly from past lives, that were always threatening to break through. And the desire to avoid pain, the desire to find happiness, that's what's fundamental, isn't it? And I always wanted to be happy. And when I was a child, of course, I didn't have a subtle understanding of it, but I had a yogic memory. So even though I was using very ordinary words, I was actually speaking of much more subtle things. I wasn't talking of, oh, I want to get married and have a nice home. In fact, my nightmare picture of my life was that I would marry, usually a dentist in this particular picture, I would marry a dentist. I'd marry a dentist who would make a good living for us, nice man, you know, it was always a good picture like that. And in those days, there were no minivans, so if you had a family, you had a station wagon. And when there were station wagons with these fake wood sides on them. So I my picture was that I was married to this dentist. I had a number of children. I had a station wagon, and there was a dog. And that would be it. Now, for many people, that would be the apex of happiness. For me, that was my nightmare scenario, that in the end, that would be all that I would have. I wouldn't have meaning. I wouldn't have purpose in life. Raising children always seemed like worth doing. It did seem worth doing, and I expected to do it, and I'm surprised in a certain sense that I haven't. But really, really deeply, I knew that wouldn't make me happy. That's why it was my nightmare, was because I knew it wouldn't make me happy, because I understood intuitively that happiness was something else. So I remember people having these horrific childhoods, you know, just like in which the desire to be happy would be desperate every day. I was perfectly cheerful. My parents loved me. They were married for 56 years. They loved each other. We lived comfortably. I had everything within reason that I wanted. They respected me. You know, you can go on with all that. So I said to Swami at one point, but I was desperate to be happy, and there was nothing in my life that would have made me unhappy. And I said, I don't understand. It was a dumb question when he answered me. He just looked at me and said, past lives. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, past lives. Been through it. Now, to me that meant at that time that I'd been through the disappointment of success because of the way I thought about the station wagon and the children, that I had the things of the world and they hadn't satisfied me, because that was how it went. I was so school smart, you know. You could be a PhD, you could be a professor, you could be a doctor, you could be a lawyer. And I would actually, like, I would sort of see all those things. I had a very visual thought. I would see myself rolling down, standing at the end of that, having accomplished it, and not being happy. And I didn't know about the spiritual path or consciousness or anything. I just knew that if that was all that I did, it wasn't that... I didn't know that I wouldn't do any of that. That was not in my thought form, but I knew if that was all that I did, I would be very unhappy. But it was much later in my life that I realized how much suffering I was running away from, because I was doing such a good job of staying ahead of it that I didn't actually know it was there. And only very slowly did I understand that it was really suffering I was running away from. Not that happened in this life, but that happens in everybody's life. You know, I mean, a psychic woman, I was telling a story once about how I went through this period of time where I was traveling a lot then. And every so often I would panic in the airport. And I mean, gosh, I traveled so much, this was not a practical thing for me to do. But every so often I would go through these panic periods in the airport, just... they would last a little while, and then I would either talk myself out of it or circumstances would settle. And I was just telling that story in some context, and this woman, who's really quite psychic, came up to me afterwards, and she said, while you were telling that, I saw you as a little girl whose mother had died, whose father couldn't take care of you, who took you on a train to a faraway city and left you in the station and then got on the train and left. Yeah, I mean, that was just what she said to me. As soon as she said it to me, like, and she said, and that's why you're having this anxiety. I don't know if it was literally true, but it was certainly apocryphal, because everything about it just, you know, I sort of, like it was an electric shock. And then I immediately answered her. It was very interesting. I said, that was a very hard life. I said, much of the strength I have now came from that life. And most of my faults came from that life. You know, that I had to become so tough in order to survive that. But I did, and I got very strong, but I got a little hard from having to. True or not, doesn't really make any difference. It fits the facts. And that was, her saying that to me, I believe was the first time I I really got, no, actually something had happened before that, but it was a very key thing, and it made me realize, oh my God, my whole personality has just been to run ahead of this, to just stay in charge, make sure that I know what I'm doing, don't mess up. Because if you know, if the facade cracks too much, oh my God, what's there? I got it once before when I was in seclusion and I was meditating, and I, you know, often when you're meditating, it's kind of a self-offering. And I don't know what put this in my mind, maybe it was something Swami said, that I thought, oh, as many as received him from the Bible, to them gave he the power. So I thought, okay, so let me try to just take in. And I was trying to think of Divine Mother's love. I mean, what could be less threatening? And I tried to take it in. But I recognized, and I can only say it was almost a physical feeling, I could feel that I had layered over a lot. And love could come in to a certain extent. I mean, if you receive God and he'll make you free, why don't we all just receive him? Seems like a kind of a no-brainer, doesn't it? So I was sitting there and I was asking myself, what is keeping this? And what I realized was all of those hurts, resentments, angers, feeling that I'd been mistreated, this is exactly what you were saying about holding on to these things. That, you know, I've been mistreated and somebody, this is what it came down to, somebody owes me an apology. That's become my little mantra. Somebody owes me an apology. And then I could think, you know, in this life of specific people that I was annoyed with, or so-and-so never understood me, this one mistreated me. But I could feel it was much deeper than that. You know, unrelinquished anger at the father who left me in the train station. Mm-hmm. Unrelinquished anger at God for allowing him to leave me in the train station. Fury at my mother for dying. I mean, I don't really remember any of those things, but past life pictures come to you and you see this. So then I really could see that, talk about likes and dislikes, you know, the main like is whatever we do, we're not really ever going to feel this stuff. We have it locked away in a room somewhere. But you see, I used to think that Swami Kriyananda was above suffering, the way I defined being above suffering, which is, oh, you know, bad and painful things happen to them, but he just doesn't feel it really. He just lives in some idea of what the spiritual path is supposed to be, and I'm supposed to be blissful all the time, so I'm blissful all the time. It took me many years to realize he actually experienced the pain of life completely, far more deeply than I could ever have imagined. Because he not only experienced it, his own reality, he experienced everyone's reality. He would watch people he loved make very bad decisions, and he would know the misery they were going to experience, and he would feel it very deeply. But he wasn't afraid of it. It was just part of the way life is. This is how we learn. He didn't fear the pains that were inflicted on him. And he didn't fear the pains that were inflicted on others. And he was not afraid. He didn't have to run away from them or wall them away. They were just simply part of what happens.
He had it in perspective.
I really, it's been very hard for me to understand, because he would say, and the saints always say, happiness, suffering, what difference does it make? Well, gosh, it sure makes a lot of difference to me. It's always made a lot of difference to me. But I've recently, and I mean this very recently, come to understand, let's say you're trying to climb Mount Everest, and I've read a lot of books about climbing Mount Everest. There's some really horrible stages in getting to the top of Mount Everest. But if you want to get to the top of Mount Everest, you can never imagine that you're going to get there without your feet freezing. And you're getting stuck on the mountain, and you're having oxygen deprivation, and having these weird experiences. But you just take it. That's part of it. You don't stand on the mountain and wish it were in the tropics, because you've decided you're going to climb that mountain. So once you've decided that I want to be free, you don't have likes and dislikes about how you get there. You don't impose upon the spiritual path one's limited ideas of what it's supposed to be, including that I'm always good, I always succeed, I always make the right decisions, you know, I'm not going to mess up, I have to make sure that I never mess up, all of these things. That's all just trying to run ahead of that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And it's a whole nother level of being a devotee. And it can't be avoided. Somehow I always thought, I always read the spiritual path to mean that you could avoid it. Somehow you just always be joyful, you know? Joy is the solution. But joy is different than pleasure. The words that I put to it are, the ego thinks that easy and pleasurable is good. The soul knows that the only thing good is that which leads to freedom. So if it's not easy and pleasurable, the ego says it's bad. The soul says if it leads to freedom, it's good. And therefore everything is good. And pleasure or pain doesn't matter. How many times have I heard that? I've never understood it. I always thought it didn't matter because you weren't feeling it. But that's different. What do you think?
When you had the when you were talking about emotion and feeling up there, and you mentioned bliss is being in feeling, and to me it is being in feeling, you know, when I felt like I've experienced it, but it's also a perception. There's the perception there also with the feeling, like in that state, this physical plane just feels so much more dense. And the Maya that I'm usually in, you know, I can see it so much more clearly as Maya. And what's truly important becomes so much more apparent. That's the perception.
That's the perception. What you're saying is that the feeling of bliss leads to wisdom.
Yes, I guess that is what I'm saying.
Because it, eight aspects of God, joy is one and wisdom is another. So you have one experience, you begin to have the other one as well.
Right. And it doesn't mean that I don't have to fully give my energy and attention to these other things.
Exactly.
I still do. But it's not where I live. It's not what's fundamental.
That's exactly right. You're living in the eight aspects of God one way or another, rather than in the Maya. And that's how Swami lived. Swami was responsible for Kriyananda, is how he put it. And Kriyananda had certain duties and things he had to carry out. And he took great responsibility for Kriyananda, and he made sure that Kriyananda did a good job of being Kriyananda. But he always also knew that it was a responsibility, not a self-definition. Which is a subtle difference, but because then when the responsibility of Kriyananda was to fail miserably and have everything just go to pieces, it was just that was his responsibility at the time. When one certain thing happened in 1981, when he stopped being a monk, and he made a partnership with this woman named Parameshwari. It's a complicated story, but they had a very strong soul connection, and he felt that Ananda, he needed to set the example of a householder life at that point, because Ananda was just completely at sea in terms of how to be spiritual householders, and everybody was just running to the monastery because they didn't know what to do. So he decided that, he felt from Master that's what he should do. So he met this woman who tremendous spiritual affinity with, but she stayed for 9 months and then she left. But in those 9 months, he put down his monastic life, he assumed a life with her, and then the only way to communicate was print media, and Yoga Journal magazine was the mouthpiece for the whole movement, and there was nothing else. But print media has a deadline of several months in advance. So an article was placed in Yoga Journal with Swami writing this beautiful article about why what was really needed now was not monasticism but householder life, and he talked about her and, you know, what their life, what it was going to be, and there was this beautiful photograph of them and all that, and by the time it was published, she was gone. So all the letters of congratulation are flooding in, and this is already history. All right? I remember Swami sitting in the living room like this, just sort of, you know, just not an ounce of tension in his body, saying, "This is a very embarrassing situation," he said. "I could be very embarrassed," he said, "but I choose not to be." Because the responsibility of Kriyananda at that point was to have global humiliation. And so there he was just going to have it, because what could he do about it? It was just what had come to him. He'd been sincere every step of the way, and it had, he was as puzzled as anyone else by the way it had all worked out. That's not what he expected, but well, there you are.
But still he set that example.
Oh my goodness, what an example it was. It took us a little time to get perspective on it, but still, even just that, here he was about as, you know, as humiliated. It was a global humiliation, and there it was. But he, it wasn't that he didn't feel it, but it wasn't personal. It was more like a tremendous opportunity had been offered to this woman, and she couldn't rise to it. She had profound misunderstandings, and it just broke his heart, really, because he saw this tremendous potential in her and this potential of what they might accomplish together, and it wasn't going to happen. And he was also, this on the other side of it, he actually got quite, depressed is the way it expressed, but he became quite withdrawn for at least a few weeks, because he had felt inwardly guided to do this. And when it completely collapsed, that caused him to doubt his intuition. And that was a very serious issue, because if he couldn't trust his intuition, how would he live? So he spent a couple of weeks just like pretty much not talking to anybody. And then one day he just appeared as cheerful as could be. And he said, there was a certain intention that I had in mind when I took this action. I felt guided by Master to do this. And that intention was that the community was very torqued at that point. People were doing what they thought they should do, and even the idea of doing what I felt to do was just being lost. If I'm serious spiritually, I want to be a renunciate, therefore I'll be a renunciate. So the monastery was just, we had 60 people, you know, like out of 150 were all in the monastery, and about 10% of them actually belonged there. You know, it just wasn't the karma, but that's what everybody felt they ought to do. But all of that dissolved because Swami suddenly came to the community and said, this is what I feel to do. And it was like everyone said, you know, doing what you feel to do, what a novel idea. and so it just flipped everything, put us back in another direction. So he realized, oh, the whole intention. He said, I never really saw myself as a householder. He said, I'm a monk by nature. I thought I would at least do it for a while, though. I thought I'd do it for longer than this. But he said, it fulfilled what the intention was. You know, people were back in themselves. He said, so who am I to say how it should have unfolded? It just unfolded as it was supposed to. And then after that, he was fine. Does that make sense? And so you ask, can you tell what is true intuition and what is not? Well, you just have things happen. Sometimes you experience global humiliation, and then you sort of look at it and think, well, how interesting. I wonder what this was about. If you're afraid to risk, then you never learn. If you're all of your life is spent running away from what might happen, or running away from what has already happened, just think how much of yourself is not accessible. And it makes you hard against others who force you to confront things you'd rather not confront. Or it makes you dull-minded because there's so much of yourself that you're really not willing to deal with. It makes you utterly confused as to why you do what you do. That would be how I would describe myself. I just utterly bewildered at my own responses. Why am I responding like this? But I never had the courage to really ask that question seriously enough. I just found myself constantly tumbling down the hills that I didn't want to be tumbling down. But I didn't have any idea why. Because it was just too scary to me to even consider what I was hiding from. And once it comes, it's not easy. I mean, this is why people leave the spiritual path. People leave the spiritual path because the spiritual path is increasing awareness. And awareness doesn't discriminate between pleasant and unpleasant. So like from the mountain, you see all the valleys too, as well as the next line of hills. So it takes tremendous courage. And the understanding that is not broken, it's actually working. When I would teach Meditation 1 courses on the last class, I would tell people, why do people stop meditating? Well, one reason they stop meditating is because it starts working. And you start becoming aware, and you don't want to be aware. So if you start, you think, before I started meditating, I didn't have to deal with all of this. So now if I stop meditating, I won't have to deal with this. And it's true, temporarily. But you can sleep for incarnations. Okay, comments, thoughts, or questions?
I go into meditation and I wait until I'm aware that I'm in a very centered place in meditation, fully in meditation. And at that point, I look at the options or I hold them up or present them, because in that state, my emotions are not involved. And then I can take a look and sometimes get a much clearer perspective. And that's been very helpful to me.
Yeah, it's true. And another thing to do is sometimes what causes us to be so insecure is, if I do this, then that will happen, then that will happen, then that will happen. And so, but we don't have any idea what will happen, because when that moment comes, the entire universe will be different than it is now. And nothing about what we perceive now will apply, because it will be a whole other cosmic universe. So sometimes the only thing that matters is the moment. Like, what am I feeling right now? Not what do I think might happen if. And that's the balance between intellect and feeling. Which is the intellect can then just spin because of the fear of the heart. But the actual feeling may be, well, this is a good thing. I think that's what I was trying to say, which, you know, things will just roll along. And that was what I watched with Swamiji is he doesn't, because he's not afraid of what might happen, he doesn't need to know what the next step is. He just knows if this step feels right, he'll just take it with just the trust that the next step is also going to be fine, because if this one was fine, what else could it be? Or if sincerely, as close as I could feel it, that's why when that thing happened with Parameshwari, but it felt like the right thing. How could it have turned out to be so disastrous? And then he found a way to, even with reason, to see why it was okay. But still, if it was the right step at the time, it was Dharma when I did it. And so if it's turned out this way, what else could I have done? I can only follow that. I remember we were involved in this very complicated political thing. This was again in 1976, actually. The planning director of the county that Ananda Village was incompetent, and Ananda was trying to get its first master plan through, and she was never going to get it. She was never going to allow it to go through. Swami saw that. The rest of us were more naive. It had already been recommended that she be fired by a grand jury investigation had recommended that she be fired, but the Board of Supervisors hadn't acted on it. It was a very backwater county at that time. So Swamiji skipped immediately out of the master plan process and started a political movement to get her fired, which totally flipped out the community, because we were not at all political at the time. He actually writes about this in the leadership book. He said, I did something very controversial. Nobody wanted to join me. But there was one person in the community that I knew if I appealed to her sense of humor, she would get involved. So I described it to her as a madcap adventure. Of course, that was me. And he did. He described it to me as just a madcap adventure that we were just going to go off on this. And he called it the Bicentennial Liberty Committee. And we were going to fight for America freedom in the county. And he sent me off, and I would do anything he asked. And he said, okay, well, you know, because he appealed to my sense of humor. But it wasn't humorous, it was very serious, because we were dead in the water. Nobody knew that but him, because we weren't sophisticated enough. And we did get her fired. It was went on for about a year and a half, and in the end, the Board of Supervisors had to fire her because she was incompetent. A competent person came in, and instantly we got off the ground. But he conducted this very I mean, he's been a king many incarnations. Later, after we did it all, he called the whole thing a tempest in a teapot, is what he called it, even though to me it looked really big. And he did this, and then he did this. I said, Swami, when we started, did you know where we were going to end up? He said, I'm not surprised we ended up there, but no, I didn't. He said, I just did what seemed right each step. And then that was when he sort of said to me, I trust. Because, see, he knows what intuition feels like. So if it felt in the way that he has earned the right to say that this was right, he didn't need to know where it was going. Because he would know the next thing when it came. So I've practiced that, even when I'm not certain, because otherwise how are you going to find out? Does that make sense?
I heard this wonderful acronym for fear, because I realized at one point all my fear was future-based, and it's future events appearing real, because the future is like a pie in the sky that never gets baked because we don't have all the ingredients.
And I put it like the whole universe will be different a day from now, so you really can't know now what you should do tomorrow because it's not tomorrow. All you can know is today. Consciousness will be different. You will be different. Everything. But that's when I went. That's why I moved to Ananda, without knowing, because the only way I could know was to develop my own consciousness. And if this next step will develop my consciousness, then it's the only possible step to take. That gives me courage. Then, where there is Dharma, there is victory. If this is righteous in itself, then it will lead to more righteousness. And even if that more righteousness is not pleasurable or easy, what is the value here? Shall we take a short breather before we come back to finish? Let's take a 5-minute breather, a little shorter break. And then we have just a short time, so whatever is left, we need to ask. That was the first time somebody ever said anything like that to me. You know, just uninvited, offered me something that was so visceral from my experience. I've had people say things, but nothing has ever gone into the heart of me like that. But I've had a couple of dreams, and I've just had intuitions that relate to what I always say about it is, if they're not true, they're apocryphal. Because it's a story that absolutely fits the experience. And if I can get a story that describes the experience, it just helps me through it. So I don't have to know whether it's true or not, because it's true, it fits the facts. And whether I really was a revolutionary in that time and was tortured to death, or, you know, whether I really was abandoned in the railroad station, it fits. Fits the way I feel. So, and I realize, I think about it, past lives and present lives are just all, it's all just absolutely the way I think about things. I don't know how you can, I couldn't make sense out of my life experience if I didn't think about having lived before. I couldn't make sense out of the incredible complexity of relationships and the prejudices that I have and the prejudices people have against me and the inability to resolve it. I just, the only way it makes sense is this is the middle of a story. Yeah.
The way I see the lives, it's like a, you know, the book, it's the whole collection of lives and the chapters.
Exactly, just chapters. And the part before and the part after. I mean, depending, in terms of all of spiritual growth being increased awareness, if someone actually can awaken you to an awareness of your past lives. Not everybody who says they can. But if somebody really can do it, it can be a very helpful thing. On certain occasions, actually, I've heard Swami actually recommend it to someone who had an inexplicable physical condition he just couldn't deal with. Swami suggested, why don't you try a past life regression? See if you can unravel where this is coming from. So it's not like a substitute for spiritual practice, but it can be an adjunct. The difficulty is finding someone who's competent, not merely capable of actually regressing you, but knowing, having enough wisdom to know what's going to help you. So it's a little tricky, but But in principle, it certainly helped me. But I've never been to anybody who's addressed me, and that woman volunteering the information just came out of nowhere. But it turned out to be God-inspired, I think. That makes sense. But now I always think in terms of, oh, well, this is why I feel about this. You know, this one and I must have had a tough time together. I was the mother superior of a convent, and I think I was not nice to a lot of those girls. So when I meet them in this life, they don't like me very much. And I can see why they don't like me, because I'm sure of it. My favorite one that was told to me was this girl. She and I never got along, ever got along. We were in India together, and it just blah, blah. Finally, she said to me, she said, I was a very happy native, a naked native, she said, and you were an English missionary who put me in a muumuu. And she said it, there it was. It was the whole thing. And I just got it, you know? I mean, it was a joke. And then after that, it wasn't heavy anymore. But she always felt like I was inhibiting her and stopping her and pushing her when I was just living my life. I wasn't really doing anything. But that was the memory between us.
You know. This makes sense because for me, going back to a
point. But that, oh yeah, well, a message with your mind. I always call Hannah Harriet. I'm sure her life was Harriet when I met her before. And there's certain people whose names I absolutely cannot get. No matter how many times they tell me, I'm certain they have another name. I mean, yours could easily be explained by just the similarity. But every time I see you, I have to stop for a minute and try to remember. I know you perfectly well, but I can't keep track as to which name is your name right now. Yeah, it's just, and it's so instinctive. It's, you know, it's a silly thing, but it, but the other, here's the important point about past lives. This is what you have to know. This happened to me at Ananda Village. I had this dream, which was absolutely true. It's the only experience I've ever had like this. All night long, I dreamt a previous incarnation in which this person with whom I did not get along at all, we had a past life in which it was a woman, she was a woman in this life, in which that person had treated me so badly, just really did, really, you know, like cinematic awfulnesses to me, super awfulnesses. And it was as real as anything. And Swami said, I think it's true. You know, I think this really did happen. So I never told this other person about the dream. Maybe Swami told her. I really don't know. So she went to a psychic person and found out what I did to her, which was equally bad. I mean, it was really a drama. It could have been a good movie. Equally bad. And Swami also said, I think that's true too. So now we were both perfectly justified in the fact of how much we disliked each other. So far from the revelation helping, it just both hardened us in our, you know, intense antipathy for each other. So Swami pulled us together and said, neither of you would ever behave like that again. He said, you've suffered and learned. So he said, what are you doing? You know, the person that you're still upset with doesn't exist. It happened, but you suffered and learned. So why are you acting as if it's a present reality? And that's the mistake that I see people make when they have past lives. Somebody owes me an apology. It's like, you did this to me, and now you have to apologize. But the person who you're trying to get to apologize to doesn't even exist anymore. They've already gone through it, and it's behind them. They don't even know what to apologize for because they've already suffered and learned. Which is mostly true, or else you see this as a really evil person and I need to get away from them, that's something different. But most of the time I see people use past lives to justify wrong attitude in the present. To explain wrong attitude is one thing, to justify it, you see, is something else. You see the difference? I find it useful because it explains it. Oh, that's why no matter what they do, I think they mean something evil toward me. And the poor, you know, the poor sap that I'm against keeps trying to tell me, you know, I love you. I'm not trying to hurt you. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. And it's just, you know, and I'm on the receiving end of it because I haven't always been nice. And so I get my poor little nuns coming to me and they're just sure that I'm going to just humiliate them in front of the whole community because I presume I did. But I don't feel that way anymore because I've suffered from it. But they want me to apologize, which I will. But of course, you can see it's crazy. So you see the difference? And that's how you work with the pains of the heart. And then it gets more subtle. Nobody's ever going to apologize to you. And even if they did, what difference would it make? That's the one I've played out a lot. What difference would it make? I mean, yes, I'm sorry is nice, but it doesn't exist. It's in me. Nobody can take away my clinging. So why am I holding on to this? That's where I got to somebody owes me an apology. Now that becomes quite cosmic, because that's telling the world that it was unfair. And Sister Gyanamata said, death to the devotee is to think you've been treated unfairly. Do you think anybody would have been that mean to you if you hadn't been that mean to somebody else at some point in your incarnations? It's all just pushing the pendulum back and forth. If somebody was, and see, sometimes people really were awful to you. It's not like they weren't. This is what you're saying. So-and-so was really awful to me. But why would I ever have attracted that? That's what that woman and I played out. I had the dream. She got the psychic. It was a perfect trade-off. Perfect. And she was awful, but gee, what do you know? So was I. And so it just had to swing. So as long as I hold to this, what I'm saying is, you were mean, but I was innocent. So you owe me an apology. Or you were mean, but I forgive you. Which is still to say, I was innocent, but now I'm going to be magnanimous. But nobody's innocent. Karma is exact. It's mathematical. Every hurt you experience, you have inflicted. These are very scary teachings. I mean, they're really scary because there's no place to hide. That's why people leave the path. It's really scary when you really just get right down to it. You just have to take it. So it was a fairly grim write-up for this class, so that's a very appropriate thing, but we don't have to end there. When someone read me this write-up, I thought, my gosh, that's just so grim. What am I going to do with that? But it's liberating, but it's not effortlessly liberating. And this is just how we get there. That's why out of 1,000 who seek God, only one finds God. And it's all right to say, okay, Lord, turn down the heat a little bit. The pot's boiling too hot for me right now. Throw me a sop, you know. Just give me something a little... I remember when I had this job at Ananda Village for which I was completely unqualified, and I made it worse by not accepting help from anyone. And finally, Swami fired me. Let's just say he relieved me of that position and gave me another one. And he relieved me of the position on a Friday. This was in the first chaotic decade of Ananda, in which we all changed jobs every few months. By him, he was just moving us around like chess pieces. And so he pulled me out of this and was going to put me there. And in this case, I knew I was being pulled out because I had failed so miserably. I wasn't just being shifted. And I said to him on Friday, I understand that I'm really going to have to learn something here, and you're going to have to say some things to me that I don't want to hear. But I'm also so happy to be out of this position. I said, why don't we just not talk about it until Monday, and then over the weekend I can just enjoy. And he said, all right. So on Monday I said, okay. And, you know, then he told me some really hard truths, and it was a number of weeks before I was able to pull myself up again. So I just said, baby me. Give me the weekend. I just don't have it. And it's fair. You have to be authentic. You can't decide in your mind that I'm this brave. I mean, that's among the things you learn when you realize how much you're running away from the pain. You realize, whew, I need a little more comfort than this. Sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't. Well, anything else that needs to be said before we stop? Is there any questions or thoughts that haven't been addressed?
You know, I noticed that other yoga path
Swami has expressed to us, and you have to, he tried to express this in a way that was both truthful but also sounded appropriate. So he would say it like this. He says, it is his belief that Yogananda's teaching of self-realization, meaning he's not the only one who taught self-realization, but Yogananda's teaching of self-realization is the Dwapara Yuga path, meaning over time it's going to influence the whole direction of society. And that doesn't mean that there aren't lots of other teachers who are doing really good things, but their mission is for a particular group like this, where Yogananda's mission is going to be setting the direction of society. And historically, in his previous incarnations and so on, that's just been the role that he's played. That's, you know, certain avatars, like Jesus is an avatar, Buddha, Krishna, they weren't merely self-realized, they weren't merely avatars. They set the direction for the whole planet for centuries to come. And part of what's happening now, this is how Swami, let's see how he put it recently. Well, how I heard him say it recently. He said it years ago. He was talking about the Gita commentary that Master wrote, and how Master's Gita commentary deals with the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual side of life. And the Gita can be interpreted on many different levels, but one of the things Master did is he interpreted it on all levels. Because the teaching of Dwapara Yuga, self-realization, is a complete integration of all aspects of life. It's not isolated monasticism, it's not the householder path is not the right path, it's not creativity should be suppressed. You know, back in the old monasteries, we lived so separated and you never expressed yourself and self-expression was anathema, you overcame the ego by crushing it. But that's not where we're going now. Now, all of it's together. So Swami wrote books about money, about marriage, about child raising, about artistic expression. He wrote music, he wrote poetry, he wrote plays. It's just like everything is all included. So there's nothing that is outside of the spiritual life. It's everything has to be approached and brought into the light. And that's even why it's community. And oh, that's what he also said. Because we, from the beginning, and this was Master's intention, we lived in communities that were householder communities. This is why back in 1981 he had to step into it. So we're raising children and earning money and trying to make marriages work. You can't just say, oh, none of that matters. Your psychology doesn't matter. Your past lives don't matter. Your emotional upsets don't matter. They all matter because the whole thing is a mess unless you straighten it all out. If you're living in a cave, you don't really have to deal with all of that. You just have to hang in there until you transcend it through meditation. Even if you're in a monastery, you don't have to deal with all that in itself. But if the pattern of the future is communities, you have to deal with all of it. So it's a complete culture. It's a whole new alternate universe. This is my explanation. Swamiji has created, in all of his writings and in the development of our communities, an entire alternative society, which is based on self-realization as the goal of life and meditation as a key practice, but not the only practice. Most of society doesn't care. But there will be a time when society will care greatly, and then they'll be astonished to see that it already exists. It'll be like discovering Van Gogh's paintings or Bach's music. We'll get to that point. But you see, if it wasn't built first, when society turned toward it, it would be too late to build it. So that's why we're just a minority movement. But yes, we're doing exactly that. Nothing is forbidden. Everything has to be viewed from the right perspective. But nothing is outside of spiritual life. Whereas other paths, no complaint. It's just they are what they are because their intention is different. And you can get to self-realization through many different methods. But this is the nature of this path, which I personally am extremely grateful for because I just don't think I could have made it any other place. Swami said to me once, you never would have made it as an SRF nun. And then he said, I don't even think you could have been a good church member. I said to him, I consider that a compliment. How did you intend it, sir? Because I don't take orders. I don't cooperate. I want to know why. If I was in a system, which is more of theirs, which is where you You know, there's a spiritual hierarchy. You fit into it. It's more traditional, all those monasteries where you don't really get to challenge authority. You accept authority, and you discipline yourself to that authority. And it's a way to grow. It's just not my way, and I wouldn't have been able to do it. I would have been there about 2 days, maybe three. Just couldn't have done it. I'm not constituted. But some people are. Some people thrive on being able to let go of everything and just concentrate on their inner reality. And so it's not invalid, it's just different. So, anything else? Okay, done. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Okay.